Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a reading and conversation presented by the Poetry Reading Series at the College of General Studies and the literary journal AGNI. Our speaker is British poet Alice Oswald. Tonight's moderator is Mary Pennard, Chair of the Arts and Humanities Division at Babson College. We begin with an introduction by Boston University Associate Professor of Humanities, Meg Tyler.
Tonight we have the good and rare fortune of welcoming Alice Oswald here to Boston University. Let me just tell you what the evening will look like. Alice will first read, and then we will follow that with a conversation with the poet Mary Pennard here. So I will introduce Mary, and then Mary will introduce Alice, and after Alice reads, they will sit here. Mary Pennard is professor of English at Babson College. Her poems have appeared in a variety of literary journals, including the Iowa Review, the Harvard Review, the Prairie Schooner, and the Georgia Review, and she has been the recipient of a number of national awards for her poetry. Her essays on poets and poetics have been published in critical anthologies and scholarly journals, and I welcome Mary Pennard. Thank you.
Meditative, musical, propulsive, mystical, atmospheric, bioregional, projective, deceptively casual, responsive, rhetorically confident, proto-echo-poetic, sonic, topographic, unsentimental, multivocal. These are just a few of the words reviewers and scholars have used to try and capture the essence of Alice Oswald's poetry. Beginning with the publication of The Thing in the Gapstone Style, which won the Forward Poetry Prize for Best First Book in 1996 and was shortlisted the same year for the T.S. Eliot Prize, readers have noted that many of her poems seem to be inspired not only by her work as a gardener at the time, but also by broader and more often than not sonic engagements with other environments in nature, including estuaries, rivers, and the sea. She says she is not a nature poet, at least in the romantic sense of those who express the continuity of humans with nature, but claims, on the other hand, to be enthralled as a poet by the contrariness of nature. She says, if the phrase must be used, then a nature poet is someone concerned with things being outside each other. How should extrinsic forms, man and earth, for example, come into contact? She found a compelling form in which to explore this contact in her 2002 book-length work, Dart, which won the T.S. Eliot Prize. Intertwined poetry and prose, some have called it a poetic census of the Dart River that captures its character from its source to its mouth. To write this poem, she spent 3 years walking along the banks of the river near where she was living at the time and working as a gardener. Over the course of these many months, she interviewed those whom she encountered. From memory, she transcribed their comments and while drafting the poem, only listened to audio recordings that she made of their transcripts. A sustained act of acoustic ventriloquy, Dart tells the river's story through an array of voices, including a poet narrator, walker, naturalist, fisherman, chambermaid, bailiff, water nymph, canoeist, town boys, swimmer, dairy worker, dreamer, oyster gatherer, naval cadet, crabber, ferryman, and seal watcher, as well as a white space of silence at almost exactly the center of the work and the murmurings of the river itself throughout. In a brief preface to Dart, Oswald describes her efforts through language and form like this. I've used these life models from which to sketch out a series of characters, linking their voices into a sound map of the river, a song line from the source to the sea. All voices should be read as the river's mutterings. In her 2005 collection, Woods, Etc., winner of the Jeffrey Faber Memorial Prize, Oswald extends her sonic and formal exploration with poems like Psalm to Sing in a Canoe and Tree Ghosts, a ballad with footnotes in which each letter commemorates a cut-down tree. In this same year, Oswald edited an anthology, The Thunder Mutters, 101 Poems for the Planet, which is, to my mind and my ear, one of the richest and most rewarding gatherings of poetry from a range of eras and geography, types of work, and weather. and she dedicates it to the rake, which, as she explains in her preface, is a rhythmical but predictable instrument that connects earth to our hands. Raking, she says, like any outdoor work, is a more mobile, more many-sided way of knowing a place than looking. When you rake leaves for a couple of hours, you can hear right into the non-human world. It's as if you and the trees had found a meeting point in the sound of the rake. She has also published Spacecraft Voyager 1, New and Selected Poems, and A Sleepwalk on the Severn, set at night on the Severn estuary and aiming to record the moon's effect on water and its effects on voices. I've taken some time to trace Alice Oswald's body of work, since it seems to me to contain and release the tides and freshets and riverine voicings that have led to her most recent, most exquisite work, Memorial, An Excavation of the Iliad. An attempt to remember, to listen, to engage the repetitions of war and grief and their sonic atmospheres, she has described this book-length poem as a kind of oral cemetery. In the aftermath of the Trojan War, an attempt to remember people's names and the lies without the use of writing. Here is the evidence, tracings of all that has come before. And I mean before not only in her work, but also before as in reaching back to Homer and those Homeric poets whose voices wrote alongside him. I'd like to end with a little piece from a BBC series on writing from a number of years ago when Alice Oswald described beginning the process of making a poem this way. Poems are written in the soundhouse of a whole body, not just with the hands. So before writing, I always spend a certain amount of time preparing my listening. I might take a day, or sometimes as much as a month, picking up the rhythms I find, either in other poems or in the world around me. I map them into myself by tapping my feet or punching the air. And when my whole being feels like a musical score, I see what glimpses, noises, smells, I see if any creature or feeling comes to live there. Then, before putting my pen to paper, I ask myself, am I listening? I invite you now to listen to the extraordinary Alice Oswald.
Thank you very much for that very generous introduction, and thank you all for coming. It's really exciting to be here. So I'd like to start with some watery poems to commemorate rainy old England, where I come from. Okay, so the first poem is The Self-Playing Instrument of Water, and this is just a poem about the kind of the way water just returns and returns, rather like those pianolas that have rolls that you keep playing, which I used to love as a child. It is the story of the falling rain, to turn into a leaf and fall again. It is the secret of a summer shower, to steal the light and hide it in a flower. And every flower a tiny tributary that from the ground flows green and momentary is one of water's wishes. And this tale hangs in a seed head smaller than my thumbnail. If only I, a passerby, could pass as clear as water through a plume of grass. To find the sunlight hidden at the tip, turning to seed, a kind of lifting raindrip. Then I might know, like water, how to balance the weight of hope against the light of patience. Water, which is so raw, so earthy strong, and lurks in cast iron tanks and leaks along, drawn under gravity towards my tongue, to cool and fill the pipework of this song, which is the story of the falling rain that rises to the light and falls again. It does keep falling again in Devon. I was very touched to hear that Meg spent some time in Exeter University and lived on Dartmoor, is that right? So I thought perhaps I should read a Dartmoor poem. Dartmoor is this incredible, I'm not going to say a wilderness because it's a strange kind of post-industrial landscape. There's been lots of tin mines and all sorts of things going on there, but it's this beautiful moorland that I look at every morning. And the centre of Dartmoor is called Cranmere Pool, and all the rivers in Devon start here. You've got the Tor and the Tavy and the Dart. And I'm really fascinated by this place because it's quite hard to get to. It's about 7 miles from the nearest road. And you trudge your way following the line of the Dart through thunder and mist and all kinds of things. And then you get to this beautiful green sponge in the middle of the moor. Nothing else there at all except these rivers bubbling up out of the ground. And I was very excited recently that I heard about... there are these kists on the moor, these kind of stone tombs, and one of them had fallen open. And it was an extraordinary story. Some walkers had reported it as falling open. And so the National Park Authority came and tried to prop the stone back, and it fell again. Something obviously wanted to get out. So they came to try and sort of take some peat samples to work out what was going on. And they put their shovel into this kist and took it out, and off the shovel rolled a little bead. So they all gasped and very carefully put the earth back and took the whole stone out and put it into a wheelbarrow and wrapped it in cling film and barrowed it off the moor into the boot of the car and quickly took it up to Chippenham, where they know how to preserve these things. And over the following week, they unpacked it slowly and discovered this extraordinary Bronze Age burial of a priestess or princess that had been buried in 1700 BC. In the autumn, they know, because the purple moor grass was there, picked in September, they could work out. And she had 108 beads made of tin and amber from the Baltic and shale. And I was just completely fascinated by this. I went up to Chippenham to have a look at her. You just can see her burnt remains and this beautiful basket of beads. And then I went to try and find where she came from. And she came from Cranmere Pool, about 200 yards from the source of the Dart, my favourite river. So I was just deeply moved by this and wanted to write a poem about it. But I can only ever really write about water. So in fact, this is really just another water poem. But you have to know that it was wanting to be about this extraordinary burial. It's called A Drink from Cranmere Pool. And Cranmere Pool used to be a lake, but it's now just a bog. Amphibious vagueness, neither pool nor land, under whose velvet three rivers spring to their tasks, in whose indecent hills, tired of my voice, I followed the advice of water, knelt, and put my mouth to a socket in the grass, as if to an outlet of my own unveiled stoneliness and sleepless flight. They say the herons used to hang like lamps here, giving off gloom. Now walkers float on the wings of their macks to this weep hole, where you can taste the last and loveliest clarities of this earth. And a little further down from that, the Dart gets bigger, and then bigger and bigger and bigger. And my second book, as Mary kindly mentioned, followed the story of this trickle that turns into a huge river that issues at Dartmouth. And so I will just give you the moment where the eel watcher is following this river, watching eels, just at the edge of the moor. The poem moves through all kinds of voices, but I'll just give you this one. Two places I've seen eels, bright whips of flow, like stopper waves the river curve slides through. Trampling around, at first you just make out the elver movement of the running sunlight. 2 foot under the road judder, you hold and breathe, contracted to an eye-quiet world, while an old dandelion unpicks her shawl, and one by one the small, spent oak flowers fall. Then gently lift a branch, brown tag and fur on every stone and straw and drifting burr. When like a streamer from your own eye's iris, a kingfisher spurts through the bridge whose axis is endlessly in motion as each wave photos its flowing to the bridge's curve. If you can keep your foothold, snooping down, then suddenly two eels let go, get thrown tumbling away downstream, looping and linking. Another time, we scooped a net through sinking silt and gold and caught one strong as bike chain, stared for a while, then let it back again. I never pass that place and not make time to see if there's an eel come up the stream. I let time go as slow as moss. I stand and try to get the dragonflies to land their gypsy-coloured engines on my hand. Well, the Dart much later on flows past my village, which is called Ashbrington. It's tidal at that stage. So I'll come inland a bit to the village. I don't think you have any equivalent in America of the dainty and decaying English village. So I'd just like to give you a little touristic sample of that. This poem sort of has a hint of all the voices of the people in the village where I live. Somebody out late again, say what you like. Sinister walk, throwing one foot forward. Black, jumble sail clothes with a bit of string around the knees going over the mud with a tread like that, throwing one foot forward. Somebody out, not back, being out again, walking every evening as regular as the rooks, throwing one foot forward. So many names in this place. Are you listening? Taking his bucket to the tap. John Strong, that's him, bursting full of himself, hook, nose, sinister walk, scars on each side of the wrist, no teeth, not known for his beauty, having been shot in the mouth, black, jumble sail clothes. Somebody out, thankfully not me, out lost in the mud. Somebody lost out late again, say what you like, a boot by the granite trough, not many of us left, living in the slippery, maybe the last green places. Are you listening? Not many of us left. Not much movement in the blackening lanes among a few low trees. Little flocks of orchids in the ditches. Nobody cares. It's as dark as a pond down here. We could do with a hedge flail. With a scythe. Somebody with a scythe. You can hear him smashing through 6-foot nettles. Black jumble sail clothes with a bit of string around the knees so as the rats won't run up his legs. Are you listening? Thomas Litch. That's him in the lane now, somebody with a tread like that, very chilblain slow with a lump on his toe. Just saw him on the way back home again, mud in his mouth. I said the dirt gets right into your fingers living under the trees like this. The toads don't mind it. This is God's honest truth. There's one about as big as a bucket, hops out of the nettles every night. You can say what you like. That's him slugging about the village, bent-headed, heavily laden with the cold. You can tell it's him. Spillikin knees, always wet for some reason, always poking the verges, looking for a tasty bit of nothing. Always wet for some reason, always standing like a bale in the rain, remembering better times, whereas naming no names, some of us would rather not remember something. Some of us have got enough bloody nightmares already. Somebody a bundle of nerves ever since the wall came down. Won't barely go out of the church now, ever since a bat swooped in like a pair of leather gloves, feeling her face. Had to dive under the pews for cover. This is God's honest truth. Joyce Jones, just heard her voice again. Say what you like. Cold nights without streetlights. Walking to the sea, perhaps on the soft of her feet with a stout stick. Why? Somebody out, peering out, not me, red face at the window, regular every evening, not noted for his warmth, this is God's honest truth, not noted for his warmth, no wife. Somebody out late, talking in the street, not many of us left, no shop, long weeds in the hedges, it's as dull as a pond down here. What a hiss in the throat, having been gassed in the war, that voice is. Are you listening? Is that somebody's bedridden red face peering out? Won't barely go out of the house now. Is that smoke? Are they burning the trees again? Say what you like. She won't like that. Not many of us left. So many names in this place. Not many of us left, living on the last we can find. Can you hear this? Somebody out peering out, not me, noticed the least likely, the very soul of respectability, eating something in the cemetery. Not rats, I hope. Are you listening? Listen, somebody's sister, the very soul of respectability, being in her slippers, having recently put out the trash, had the misfortune to die over the dustbins in the snow. Lynn Waters, of course, somebody had to shift her, say what you like, just saw him with a grim look, put her in the car boot, cold as a trout, with a bit of green silk around the middle to protect against rheumatism. Somebody is barely there, as light as a lace curtain, lying in the nettles with her teeth upwards. Couldn't shift herself. Been living off nettles for a week, hence the expression. Somebody on her knees again, not what she was. Somebody screaming again last night, being strangled or something. Good grief, you get used to the sounds. Not many of us left, living on the fluff of green of the last little flows of the earth. That poem's getting truer as the waters rise. We really are on one of the last little flows. I can't really tell the time on this Mickey Mouse watch, but I think I will now read some of Memorial, which, as Mary said, is a sort of excavation of the Iliad, by which I mean that the Iliad, I think, is a poem that happens in layers and layers and layers, and you can dig down through it. So I've dug away the first layer, stripped it of its narrative, and got down to the layers of individual soldiers and their stories. And each soldier is accompanied by a simile. So this is a long poem, and what I will do is read from the beginning, miss out the middle, and read from the end. So you'll get a sort of the two edges of a sandwich. And you don't really need to know the context. All you need to know is that I think the people mentioned in the Iliad were real people. So this poem commemorates real soldiers. The first to die was Protesilaus, a focused man who hurried to darkness with 40 black ships leaving the land behind. Men sailed with him from those flower-lit cliffs where the grass gives growth to everything. Pyrrhus, Iton, Ptelius, Antron. He died in mid-air, jumping to be first ashore. There was his house, half-built. His wife rushed out, clawing her face. Podarchus, his altogether less impressive brother, took over command. But that was long ago. He's been in the black earth now for thousands of years. Like a wind murmur begins a rumour of waves. One long note getting louder, the water breathes a deep sigh. Like a land ripple, when the west wind runs through a field, wishing and searching, nothing to be found, the cornstalks shake their green heads. Like a wind murmur begins a rumour of waves, one long note getting louder, the water breathes a deep sigh. Like a land ripple, when the west wind runs through a field, wishing and searching, nothing to be found, the cornstalks shake their green heads. Acapulus, a perfect fighter, always ahead of his men, known for his cold, seed-like concentration, moving out and out among the spears, died at the hands of Antilochus. You can see the hole in the helmet just under the ridge where the point of the blade passed through and stuck in his forehead, letting the darkness leak down over his eyes. Elephenor from Euboea, in command of 40 ships, son of Chalcodon, nothing is known of his mother, died dragging the corpse of Acapulus, a little flash of flesh showing under the shield as he bent. Agenor stabbed him in the 9th year of the war. He wore his hair long at the back. Like leaves, Sometimes they light their green flames and are fed by the earth, and sometimes it snuffs them out. Like leaves, sometimes they light their green flames and are fed by the earth, and sometimes it snuffs them out. Simoisius, born on the banks of the Simois, son of Anthemion, his mother, a shepherdess, still following the sheep when she gave birth. A lithe and promising young man, unmarried, was met by Ajax in the ninth year of the war and died, full tilt, running onto his spear. The point passed clean through the nipple and came out at the shoulder blade. He collapsed instantly, an unspeakable sorrow to his parents. And Lucas, friend of Odysseus, little is known of him except his death. And someone's face pierced like a piece of fruit. That was Priam's son, unlucky man who made his living in the horse country north of Troy. He was stepping backwards when the darkness hit him with a dull clang. His name was Democoon. Like a man steps back, seeing a snake almost under his foot in a heathery hollow. The fear flutters his knees. It sucks him white. He steps back. Like a man steps back, seeing a snake almost under his foot in a heathery hollow. The fear flutters his knees. It sucks him white. He steps back. Diores, son of Amarynceus, struck by a flying flint, died in a puddle of his own guts, slammed down into mud. He lies with his arms stretched out to his friends, and Pirous, the Thracian, you can tell him by his knotted hair, lies alongside him. He killed him and was killed. There seem to be black flints everywhere a man steps. Like through the jointed grass, the long-stemmed deer almost vanishes, but a hound has already found her flattened tracks, and he's running through the fields towards her. Like through the jointed grass, the long-stemmed deer almost vanishes, but a hound has already found her flattened tracks, and he's running through the fields towards her. The priest of Hephaestus, hot-faced from staring at flames, prayed every morning the same prayer. Please, God, respect my status. Protect my sons, Phegeus and Idaeus. Calm down their horses. Lift them out of the fight, as light as ash. Hephaestus heard him, but he couldn't hold those bold boys back. Riding over the battlefield, too fast, they met a flying spear, and like a lift door closing, inexplicable Hephaestus whisked one of them away, and the other died. What happened to that man from Alibi, far away in the east? What happened to Odysseus? What happened to Phaestus? He came from Tarni, where the soil is loose and crumbly, like snow falling, like snow when the living winds have shaken the clouds into pieces, like flutters of silence hurrying down to put a stop to the earth at her leafwork, like snow falling. Like snow, when the living winds have shaken the clouds into pieces, like flutters of silence hurrying down to put a stop to the earth at her leafwork. Scamandrius, the hunter, knew every deer in the woods. He used to hear the voice of Artemis calling out to him in the lunar no man's land of the mountains. She taught him to track her animals. But impartial death has killed the killer. Now Artemis, with all her arrows, can't help him up. His accurate firing arm is useless. Menelaus stabbed him, one spear thrust through the shoulder, and the point came out through the ribs. His father was Strophius. Like when a mother is rushing, and a little girl clings to her clothes, wants help, wants arms, won't let her walk, like staring up at that tower of adulthood, wanting to be light again, wanting this whole problem of living to be lifted and carried on a hip. Like when a mother is rushing and a little girl clings to her clothes, wants help, wants arms, won't let her walk, like staring up at that tower of adulthood, wanting to be light again, wanting this whole problem of living to be lifted and carried on a hip. And Hector died like everyone else. He was in charge of the Trojans. But a spear found out the little patch of white between his collarbone and his throat, just exactly where a man's soul sits waiting for the mouth to open. He always knew it would happen. He who was so boastful and anxious and used to nip home deafened by weapons, to stand in full armor in the doorway like a man rushing in, leaving his motorbike running. All women loved him. His wife was Andromache. One day he looked at her quietly. He said, "I know what will happen." And an image stared at him of himself dead and her in Argos weaving for some foreign woman. He blinked and went back to his work. Hector loved Andromache, but in the end he let her face slide from his mind. He came back to her sightless, strengthless, expressionless, asking only to be washed and burned, and his bones wrapped in soft cloths and returned to the ground. Like leaves, who could write a history of leaves? The wind blows their ghosts to the ground, and the spring breathes new leaf into the woods. Thousands of names, thousands of leaves. When you remember them, remember this. Dead bodies are their lineage, which matter no more than the leaves. Like chaff, flying everywhere at threshing time. The winnowers waft their fans, and the wind does its work, and a goddess is there picking the grain from its husk, while a fine white dust covers everything. Like thousands of water birds, mill and mass in the air, great gatherings of geese and cranes and long-necked swans flaring and settling in those fields where the rain runs down to the caister, continually shuffling and lifting and loving the sound of their wings. They shriek as they land, like a huge bird fair, a valley full of voices. Like wandering tribes of flies that gather in sheds in shadowy spring when the milk splashes in the buckets. Like crickets, leaning on their elbows in the hedges, tiny dried up men speaking pure light. Like strobe lit wasps that have built their nest on a footpath, never give up their hollow house, but hang about the walls, worrying for their children. Like tribes of summer bees coming up from the underworld out of a crack in a rock, a billion factory women flying to their flower work, being born and reborn and shimmering over fields. Like locusts lifted, rippling over fields on fire, fleeing to the river, a hanging banner of insects trying to outfly flame, they hide by drowning. Like restless wolves, never run out of hunger, can eat a whole stag, can drink the whole surface off a pool, lapping away its blackness with thin tongues and belching it back as blood, and still go on killing and killing with their stomachs rubbing their sides, haunted by hunger. Like when water hits a rocky dam, its long, strong arms can't break those stones, and all its pouring rush curls back on itself and bleeds sideways into marshes. Like when God throws a star and everyone looks up to see that whip of sparks and then it's gone. Like when God throws a star and everyone looks up to see that whip of sparks and then it's gone. Thank you.
Well, I feel enormously speechless at the moment after that extraordinary. It felt like something other than a reading somehow, like an invocation, like a, I don't know, I want to ask you about voice and your voice as a poet and how you hold so many voices and deliver them with such extraordinary presence and energy and authenticity. And then I'm very interested also in the voices you like to listen to or read as a poet.
I think originally I started minding very much about the voice of my poems when I noticed that people tended to read them with a kind of iambic meter. And I very much don't write in an iambic, but well, I sometimes do. I sometimes deliberately write very iambically, but I prefer the kind of dancing meters of the Greek poets, which I don't use exactly, but I prefer those kind of dactyls. I love that kind of da-da-da. So I was finding that when people read my poems on the page, they didn't really understand their tunes. So it started to become very important to me to read them out loud. And so now that's become part of my writing, that I think of them as spoken tunes and I mind about how they sound. So I'm really focusing very much just on the rhythms when I speak them. Mm-hmm. So perhaps that's why there's a sense of urgency, because I really want people to hear the rhythms that I've put so much work into making.
Yes. And so when you're making them, you talk about sort of tapping and connecting with those rhythms. So I'm wondering about your process at that stage. When are you writing the rhythms and then saying them again and again? Are you hearing them and then transcribing them?
I think as soon as you say that you do one thing, you end up wanting to do something else.
Yes.
I'm very wary of ever saying anything about poetry. My general model is that I feel that there are kind of tunes around, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. I like to try and hear them and then see how they match with whatever it is that's in me. Okay. So that's my image, is that I'm listening to a tune that already exists. And sometimes they do already exist, because I quite like writing very formal poems. Sometimes I'm spotting tunes. I do quite a lot of spotting tunes visually, like in the outlines of landscape. I see that as a tune.
Okay.
Or just the kind of rather lovely chaos of sounds that one is surrounded by in a house or outdoors. And I am very drawn to taking my tunes from outdoors, just because my kind of principle with my writing is that I want my poems to be alive, so I tend to want to take my tunes from living, living things and living processes.
If I could just follow up and ask a question about form, and then maybe we could open it up. Would that be okay? I feel some urgency coming this direction too. You know, people have questions. I know you write in forms, sonnets and ballads and so forth, but you also are creating voice out of the physicality of the world, and that may have form or not. So can you talk a little bit about that decision where you know you're going to make a sonnet about the sea, perhaps several sonnets about the sea, and then it's going to be something else, perhaps something like what happens in Memorial, where it's that stratification, it's that access to the voice and the repetition of the simile, which is a very different kind of structure. You could call it a structure.
Form is, it's the biggest question that you have to approach each time you write. And I think it is the particular difficulty of a contemporary poet, that you have so much choice whether you use a traditional form or you find your own forms. So it's kind of an agony every time I sit down, because I know that I believe that that rhythm and form are forms of perception. So that if you use a sonnet, you see a kind of sonnet-shaped world, and if you use the stress-based meters, which I prefer, you see that kind of world. And so I'm very aware that the choice of form affects the subject. And sometimes I play around, you know, a poem could be a formal sonnet until the last minute when I just find it's too sort of polite and suddenly I'll smash it and the poem will come out of that sort of that demolition at the very end. Or the other way around, I'll sometimes write something as a free poem that just is too limp and so then I'll put it into form at the very last minute. Mm-hmm. But the best poems, I think, are when you simply... I actually generally prefer my informal poems to my formal ones. Mm-hmm. And they work if they have a strong enough tune. And I think I noticed quite early on that the so-called free verse poems that I like are the ones that use emphatic song-like rhythms, despite getting rid of rhyme or whatever. They still have those stressed rhythms. I've always been quite irritated by free verse that sort of wobbles in and out of an iambic pentameter, mm-hmm. because it seems to me that what's brilliant about the iambic pentameter is that it is a talking rhythm. So if you take away its formality, you've got nothing left. Whereas if you use, you know, a strongly emphatic line, yes. you can get rid of the rhyme or the number of syllables, and you've still got a beautifully shaped tune.
Yes,
I think that's what drew me so much to Ted Hughes's poems. Was mm-hmm. he, you know, he just really uses strong tunes, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and you can't call them free because they're so strong.
Yes.
If that answers your question.
It does, and it kind of explodes my mind with more questions. But I'm going to restrain myself. And are there questions? Do people have questions? We have a question here.
Because you're so aware, or because tune matters so much to you, and the life of the poem matters so much to you, I can see why this would not sound the same read by somebody else. And do you have any hesitation about recording your own poems?
Recording my own poems?
Yes.
Or getting other people?
I mean, is there enough life in that?
It's a very good question, because there are now options, of course, to record poems, you know, as digital recording gets so sophisticated. And to me, it is certainly better than not doing it. But I am a real believer in live performance. And I know that something dies each time you record or video something. I just know it. And so, to me, there is a real value in getting a human body, like a musical instrument, to stand up and play. That's better than anything. But if you can't do that, I think there is great value in recording. I'm worried about the kind of arrogance of not wanting other people to read my poems. I think that's a big failing of mine. But if they could read the tunes right, I wouldn't mind.
So will you record?
I have recorded quite a lot. I've recorded Memorial and Dart, and I'd love to do more if I get more chances. Mm-hmm. I think, yeah. On the other hand, I quite like the idea that you can starve people and then they have to come to performances. because, of course, if you record everything, then there's no reason for people to go and right. hear poetry live.
There seems to be a bit of a slight move in the UK and here towards poetry collections or poetry books that have a very strong central theme, or are one poem, or are a sequence. And I wonder, and you know, obviously Memorial and Dart fill that role. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you start out when you're doing that thinking that's what you're going to do, because in my sort of practice when I write, there's a million poems going on, not a million, but lots of poems going on at once, and it'd be very hard for me to imagine thinking this is the beginning of 80 pages of a poem, or even a sequence of poems with such a strong central... I mean, I was reading someone the other day who talked about these kinds of collections as comparing them to sort of 1970s concept albums, that there was a kind of concept album poet, and then there was a kind of greatest hits poet, and there were two different kinds of poets. There was the one who had the concept, and there was the one that had lots of songs collected.
You've touched a very sore nerve of mine, because although I love launching into a big project, and I've done Dart, Memorial, Sleepwalk, I'm always writing short random poems on the side. You know, I do the two things at the same time, and I really believe in the importance of the lonely single poem that has to make its own context, that has to become urgent enough that you don't need the book to be called tree poems or water poems or whatever. I really believe that these themed collections are actually, you know, they're easy to review and they're easy to give prizes to, but sometimes you just get much more interesting poems if you take them out of their context and see them. And that's the real test of a good poem. Can it be on the London Underground, for example, on its own? And my God, those ones on the Underground are amazing when you just read them without anything else. So I think it's a really important point, and I really try to do both, because I think they use very different skills, and the kind of swiftness that you need for writing a long poem is good, but the coherence you need for an individual poem is really important.
Thanks.
Because what makes a poem whole? You know, a short poem has to last as long as a long poem. That's what I love. It has to be infinite in the same way the long poem is infinite.
So when you started Dart or Memorial, did you know at the very start that you were going to write it as a long poem, or did it just turn out that way?
Those two I did, and I always, when I'm doing a long poem, I think it's going to be a good 1,000 pages and will take me the rest of my life. So what you actually see is fragments of what I'd conceived.
Right.
But at the same time as writing both of those, I was also writing short poems.
Okay.
Thank you for that beautiful reading. I'm wondering if you see what you see as the relationship of your poetry to politics, however you interpret that. Is there a politics to the poetics of landscape as you see it, or to the act of commemoration in Memorial? And is that something that comes with the original idea of the poem, or is that sort of superimposed upon it later when you go back and think about it as a project?
Yeah, that's such a good question, because it's essential that poetry doesn't remove itself from politics. But it's also essential that poetry doesn't have opinions or doesn't kind of set out to express its opinions. And what's really important for me is that when you write a poem, the poem is free to say what it wants rather than that I'm free to say what I want. So I really believe two contradictory things. I'm a very contradictory person. I think that the poem knows more than me, so it's not for me to put my opinion in it. But I also think that poems need to be responsible to the contemporary world they live in. And my hope is that if you concentrate hard enough, politics will come through. But you shouldn't do it deliberately, because otherwise you'll mistranslate what the poem really wants to say. Does that answer your question?
Thank you.
I was really interested when you said that form for you is a mode of perception and not a form of representation, for instance. And I wondered if you would say a little bit about form is almost a practice, like a type of practice of seeing and hearing, as you've talked about, and more about that. And I always think of form as a form of representation, you know, a sonnet or a sestina or something, and as a recreation, a sort of secondary recreating of some perceptive information. And I wondered if you would talk more about form as perception for you personally.
So you're drawing a distinction between seeing form as a container that you pour your thoughts or perceptions into, or whether it is the perception itself, which is what I've claimed. And I think that really, just in a very practical way, from experimenting with forms and non-forms, and seeing that, well, for example, rhythm, you know, if you can use a light, ironic rhythm, and you will see a light, ironic world. And if you use, you know, the stronger your rhythms, the more disturbing things you see. And I just know that that happens because I've tried it, and you can kind of navigate around your own brain by means of rhythm, I think, and you can make those choices. And you can, it's very possible to write a sonnet where you simply pour the content in like a sort of measuring jug, but I think the real challenge is to, in the same way that if you read a whole Shakespeare play, your mind just falls into this kind of five-petaled pattern. You just start to see everything in this extraordinary five-stressed way, and everything becomes patterned. And I think if you get a tune kind of soaked into you really thoroughly, then you see what, am I making sense? Mm-hmm. Then that's the world you see. Mm-hmm.
You're almost suggesting there's like a simultaneity of perception and representation where form is concerned.
I think there is, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think, I'm sorry, I'm working it out as I'm speaking, which is why I'm hesitating a little bit. Because I feel as if I'm saying something more than just the practicalities of what I've noticed. But I maybe need to think a little bit harder about it. Does it resonate with things other people have found who write? A few nods. because I think you know that perception is something you kind of you can change the lenses on it. Mm-hmm. So I don't believe it's just straightforward that you look at the world and you get the information. You kind of adjust your ways of seeing. Mm-hmm. I hope that vaguely answers.
I think we should thank Alice now and let her drink some wine.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a reading and conversation with British poet Alice Oswald. Tonight's event was presented by the Poetry Reading Series at the College of General Studies and the literary journal AGNI. Our moderator was Mary Pinard, Chair of the Arts and Humanities Division at Babson College. We began with an introduction by Boston University Associate Professor of Humanities, Meg Tyler. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Marquise Neal. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.